SoFi, the all-in-one super app for banking, borrowing, and investing. Earn industry-leading APY, get great loan rates, and trade stocks. SoFi, get your money right. Banking products and loans offered by SoFi Bank N.A., NMLS 696891. Brokerage and active investing products offered through SoFi Securities, LLC, member FINRA, SIPC. Not that I was in Vietnam.
You were not.
Well, that's
you could have been.
I haven't been to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Not that I was in the conflict,
yeah.
The war in Vietnam, because I was too young.
Yes.
I was born in 1963. But Dan was just telling a story about the first time that he met the folks on CNBC's Fast Money.
Yeah, as a guest.
As a guest. You came on as a guest.
Yeah.
And what Dan was saying is, first time he came on, none of us
said
anything.
Hi. Nothing.
Greeted you.
Didn't even say hi.
And what I was going to tell, what I've told him before and what I'll tell the audience is, you know, the amount of people they paraded through that show over the years and, you know, they came and went. So in the NAM, in the shit, you learn, you just don't get to know people's names because there's a good chance in 2 weeks they're not going to be around anyway.
Yeah.
That's what you learned in the NAM.
15 years
I didn't
later,
learn that in NAM. I learned that from watching Platoon.
Yes.
Yeah, now you're still here. So you made it through.
I made it.
Now that's just
that's
an anecdotal
the explanation
thing.
Of the ice cold welcome that you
yeah. yeah, there you go. What was it here, guy?
Well, this is Market Call. It's 1 o'clock on the East Coast. Today is the 10th of April. We're now in double digits. The month is just flying by.
I don't like that.
Elizabeth Young, that of course, EY from SoFi, Dan Nathan, and myself. Also, before the show started, I looked up and I saw Elizabeth sitting across from me. I said, you did a nice job with the ombre there in your hair. And she said, yes, I did.
Yeah. I know,
yes,
you
I
call
did.
It ombre.
Huh?
It's actually called balayage. The
now it's balayage.
They use to, yeah. I got some very subtle highlights that you guys probably cannot tell.
No, I noticed.
Guy noticed. He,
I
is,
did
he
not.
Is the second person to notice.
You know what I noticed?
That
I noticed,
the market's lower.
You know, it's amazing. And, you know, Liz came on a few weeks ago and her main man, Mario, had a great stat about it was almost like a year since the S&P had a 2%.
Well, we're still not there yet.
I know we're not, which is absolutely amazing because, guy, the longer we stick around down just 1% on the day, it makes me think like at some point they're going to rally them back for whatever reason.
We've seen that before.
We have seen them.
And, you know, we have a bond auction. We're probably in the midst of it.
Just crossing the tape right now.
Just crossing the tape right now. See, I'm in Elizabeth.
4.56 versus 4.53 pre-sale. So 10-year yields just shot up to 4.55.
As they should.
Wow.
Yeah.
And that's not... And I got to look at, you know, that's obviously the when issue. We got to look at the demand and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Anywho, this is Market Call. Let's take a look at the rundown, shall we? By the way, as we look at the rundown, the Rangers lost last night
to the Islanders. Horrible.
Which the Islanders, to me, have never... The way that game unfolded, now I got a bit of a Jones for the Islanders. So you know what? Bring that shit on in the playoffs, and they play Saturday night.
Yeah, they do.
Last night was almost a perfect night, and I'll tell you the reasons why. Because on four consecutive channels, and I don't have Amanda in my ear yelling at me because I don't have my IFB in, you had the Yankees who emerged victorious against the Marlins. So the Yankees win. The Knicks in Chicago, the Knicks win 2-for-2. The Mets lose, although they made it close late, but that's 3-for-3. But the Rangers lost.
What's the Marlins record?
2-11 or 2-10.
Are we proud of that win? Or
you know, Elizabeth, as you know, because you're a sports fan, you play who's on the calendar. You don't control who's on the schedule.
That's right. Okay.
Anyhow, stocks sink on hot inflation. Yes, it was. Are Fed rate cuts off the table? Question mark. Well, they better damn well be. FactSet's earnings insight. That's little Butters.
That's John Butters.
And an audience Q&A. Because if it's Wednesday, it's Sunday at Carvel. It's also audience Q&A with Elizabeth Young from SoFi. So let's go. Let's take a look at things. Shall we, Dan?
All right. Let's do this. I'm going to throw up a chart. You know, we are on the Insta. You are at Liz Young Strat. Mm-hmm. I am Dan S. Nathan and Guy is Guy Dadadami. But we have the at-risk reversal media thing. And we do a little preview of on the Insta in the morning about we're going to do on this program. And, you know, to me, it was interesting. So getting that data, Liz, and we saw yields spiked, you know, immediately. And that's the thing that we would have expected last week, you know, on that jobs report. I would have expected them to have gone a little higher here. So they were really waiting to see what the inflation data was saying. But let's throw this chart up. This is the S&P versus the 10-year U.S. Treasury yield. The last time the U.S. Treasury yield was on its way to breaching that 4.5% level, okay, it obviously went straight to 5% or so. You know, the S&P was below 4,600 on its way to 4,100. Okay. So we closed yesterday above 5,200. Now we're, you know, closer to 5,150 now. Liz, when you think about this relationship, is this an important relationship to you? Because we're going to get into whole other reasons. These are just two inputs here. But like, to me, I think it's a pretty interesting scenario. We've been talking about it. I think that we're going to see these two lines converge again.
Well, so here's the thing. The data came out today. I think what was going on yesterday was actually that the market, if you peeled back the onion, what the market was expecting was a cooler print and for the Fed to stay on course for about three cuts this year. And that's obviously not what happened. So some of the things that were happening yesterday, you saw factors like momentum really dragging things down. And then you saw other factors like short interest dividend yield really bringing things back up. That to me says we're expecting a cool print. We're expecting a dovish Fed. That's not what we got at all. So now we had to not only reverse some of that, but then start to digest the idea that immediately we went from 61% chances of a cut in June to 28%. We are sitting, when I look at this today, we're sitting here right now at 18% chances of a cut in June. So immediately everything got pushed out, another cut, and the market is trying to figure that out too. This, I think today, was the pivotal moment where we've digested this up until now. We've digested it okay until now. We started with six cuts this year. Now we're at maybe one or two. And this was the moment where we stopped digesting it well.
So, Guy, how is the knee-jerk reaction in the stock market, okay, only down 1%? And I know, like, initially it was down, like, 1.5% in the pre-market. We know that's, like, you know, futures trading and the like here. But here we are. You know, you've had hours to digest all of this information. And the fact of the matter is, yeah, you have some big stocks diverging. NVIDIA, which is obviously a big stock in the S&P, is up on the day. Walmart's up on the day. There's a few other big names that are up in the day. But look at what's gone on in these interest rate-sensitive names. I mean, J.P. Morgan's down 1.5%. It was down a lot, you know, at one point yesterday. So how is the S&P, just explain this to me, only down 1%?
Well, I mean, I don't know what Liz thinks about this. I'll say again, first of all, I always believe that moves to the downside are more violent than moves to the upside. Typically, historically, that's the case. But to answer your question, you know, I think what I've learned the hard way over the years is, you know, with the advent of passive investing, how important it is. Passive investing money flows into the market on days like today. What we're talking about now has no bearing whatsoever on the flows that make their way into the market. So these sell-offs are somewhat mitigated by the fact that money just flows into the market seemingly on a daily basis. The question, though, and this is what I struggle with, and this is what I think will happen, there's going to be an inflection point where passive becomes active, where somebody, where people start to look up and say, hey, wait a second, what's going on here? And the active portion of this equation won't be money flowing into the market. It'll be money coming out of the market, like, get me out. I see what's going on. We're not at that point. I want to be crystal clear. We're not at that point yet. But that's sort of, you mentioned inflection points for the data. That's the inflection point for the market.
Right, but Liz, if you're a big institutional investor here and you've had all this time to digest this rate hiking cycle, right? And then you got really comfortable. I think we had Chris Harvey on Fast Money last night, Guy, pushed back on something you said about, you know, like the notion that, you know, if you see rates going higher, that means the economy is better. Now, there's a couple ways you dice that. So there's no reason why stocks shouldn't continue to benefit from inflationary pressure and the like here. I kind of don't agree with that a little bit, Liz, but, you know, at sooner or later, you have to feel like that inflation is going to become embedded in the economy, and that's going to weigh on margins. And if it weighs on margins, it means that there's going to be pressure on earnings. And if we already think that, you know, S&P at 21 times, this is per our main man Butters at FactSet, is trading well above the 5 and 10 year average, I think, of 18 and 17% or so, at some point, doesn't the stock market have to start discounting, you know, like lower earnings growth?
Yeah, well, and I think part of it is that chart that you just had up. When we were back in whatever that was, from August to, let's say, October, rates were rising, the S&P was falling. And we were at that point digesting, okay, what makes sense as valuations right now? And that's what the market told us made sense at that point. If we're making our way back up to 4.75, 4.8 in the 10-year, and then 5 in the 10-year, you have to believe that S&P valuations do not deserve to be at this level unless earnings start to do extra work. But earnings have to start doing extra work and the economy has to start doing extra work. Mm-hmm. The other thing is the reasons that yields have risen will be debated forever. But I think what's happening at this juncture is it's different than what we saw happen with inflation the first time around. Mm-hmm. This juncture is now a reignition in inflation driven by commodity prices and driven by geopolitical risk.
Isn't that the main point, Guy?
It's been embedded.
You've been saying for 2 years that inflation is going to be more pesky and persistent than most people feel. And I just want to say about her point about the earnings. What did you just say that like they're going to have to work harder?
Earnings
or something
are going
like
to have to work harder.
The problem, Guy, is what Chris Harvey pushed back on you was, and he's a strategist at Wells Fargo, and we think very highly of him. He's a great guy. He's been coming on the show for a long time. But, Guy, one of the main points was generative AI. The generative AI is going to be that earnings accelerator here. I know, but it's so narrow, I guess, is my point. You know what I mean? Speak to that, because it's also a big part of the S&P 500 earnings are the names that are benefiting from generative AI.
One of the things I will push back, one of the things that you said is people seem to think this spending in generative AI needs to be done by definition.
He said it's not discretionary.
I disagree. Yeah. And I think you disagree as well. I'm not looking to put Elizabeth on the spot, but that's part of the rub as well. If things start to go a little pear-shaped here, I think it will be extraordinarily discretionary. And that's when you can see, we mentioned inflection points. Inflection points in some of these huge names like NVIDIA, Micron to a certain extent, the super microcomputer and all these names that are sort of predicated on exactly that. But to your point about being embedded, that's why, again, if all the economy was the stock market, and I've said this, has nothing to do with who I vote for, who I want. It's nothing to do with politics. President Biden's approval rating for the economy should be in the 70s, if not higher. It should be at historic highs. It's at historic lows because it has nothing to do with the stock market. It has everything to do with the fact that people are feeling the squeeze. And you don't have to believe me. Listen to all the commentary we've heard from companies across a swath of industries, including effing McDonald's a month or so ago, that said, you know what? Their customers feeling the never in the 17 years we've done Fast Money, I've never heard commentary out of McDonald's like that. That's typically where people go if they're feeling squeezed. Now people are feeling squeezed and they can't go to McDonald's.
Yeah. So, Guy, not that we cheat on Liz Young, EY from SoFi. There's another Liz that we really like out there in the strategy.
Oh, I like her too.
I know you do.
Ann Saunders.
Yeah. Let's pull up a tweet that she had here, because I think this is kind of interesting, Liz. If the stock market, the S&P took off in mid-December, right, when basically that Fed presser, right, was December 13th or so, market participants really felt like they were going to be able to drop the mic and lower interest rates for good reasons, right? So if you see what expectations are right now, and I think you just said it, June is basically gone at 16% if you look at the CME Fed Funds tracker here. So now you're expecting two cuts, but one of them is not going to happen until after the election, most likely, right? So maybe they just get pushed all together. How much should we be focused? How much should equity investors now be focused on rate cuts? Guy's been saying it for an awful long time. Careful what you wish for, because when they start cutting, it might be for the wrong reasons.
I do believe it's going to be for the wrong reasons, and I will stand by that. And I'll read a passage from my blog for tomorrow later. But so equity investors should be focused on this, first of all, for one of the reasons that we've mentioned, because the market tends to do okay between hikes and cuts. You don't want the cuts to come faster. That's usually what sets off a sell-off. And then you see the market bottom typically after the cuts begin. So you don't want them to come faster, because wouldn't that just send us into a little bit of a tailspin? The other thing is we have to be focused on it now because it's dragging it out. And I've said this before, if we get to that November meeting, it will be the longest pause ever, which again, we're going to set records in this cycle over and over and over again. Longest yield curve inversion, longest Fed pause. Now it's a matter of how much stamina do we have to withstand the capital constriction? Why hasn't it shown its face yet in a lot of places, both in the economy and in the market? And at some point, is there going to be something that pops up out of nowhere and says, oh, wait, this has been a problem the whole time. We just didn't know about it. It was happening under the surface.
By the way, ask questions. We are fielding our crack staff. Our crack staff, of course, being Amanda Diaz, Jacob, Timmy. I mean, that's our crack staff.
Yeah.
They're fielding the questions.
What about,
now.
What about our main, the funny man, Bill Hockman?
Oh, Hock, but Hock runs. See, he's not fielding questions.
He's not
like,
even listening.
All this stuff you see, yeah, that's what he takes care of. He's that guy. So he doesn't. Hi, Bill. Bill's looking in.
Bill. But let's take a quick look at some of the reactions in the stock market by sector here today, because I think this is kind of interesting, and you can see some of the rate sensitive stuff here is getting hardest hit here. So that real estate index, and you know, there's a lot of volatility there. If you just look at the utilities, okay, so yields higher, that makes sense. You see the XLU down a bit. Guy, anything stick out here from a sector standpoint interesting? Obviously, XLE is the only one up. That's something you've been pounding the table on for a very long time.
Yeah, well,
I just went down in the day.
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of makes sense. This makes sense when you look at this in a snapshot. But then there are individual names out there, and just throw NVIDIA up, for example. And I mentioned that because, as you said earlier, we're on the gram. And one of the things I put on the gram today was, you know, that March 8th reversal day is holding up. And we've flagged it a number of times. So look at NVIDIA today, and it was opening gap lower around 835. It clawed its way back today. So we'll see how long this lasts, but there's clearly some battle lines being drawn in the form of NVIDIA right now. So that is an individual name sticks out to me. But, you know, the persistent strength of energy relative to everything else, you know, I thought that would be a theme last year. That was right. It was wrong. I thought it'd be a theme this year. It's proven to be somewhat correct. And we'll see how this continues to play out. But rates going higher is absolutely going to have an impact on the technology sector. And obviously, as you mentioned, some of these interest rate sensitive names.
All right, let's talk about like banks. This week, we're going to get JP Morgan, Citi, Wells Fargo. I think BlackRock also not a bank, but on Friday morning, Liz. And then it's interesting to me what sticks out as far as I just mentioned, you know, the money center banks being down like this. You know, we could talk a little bit about net interest margins. We can also talk about the last time we saw rates going up in this way. It was about a year ago. We saw some major regionals go under. Look at the regionals down nearly 5%, the KRE today. So again, is a precipitous move from 5% possible, or, you know, from 4.5% possibly back up to 5%, is that going to cause some problems among some of these regionals?
It definitely could. Yeah. I mean, all the unrealized losses issue comes back.
Mm-hmm.
The thing that we thought was solved. Not only did we bail out or save some of the issue that occurred, and, you know, obviously assets got redistributed, big banks benefited from that. But as rates rise, unrealized losses also rise. And depending on the exposure and depending on the capital that those banks already have, yeah, I think it could create a problem. The big bank earnings that we're going to start hearing, and this is always important, but I think particularly important now, is to listen to what the CEOs say about, I would say, the consumer sector. Mm-hmm. Have they made more allowances for charge-offs? Have they increased loan loss reserves? Are they looking ahead because of some softening in demand in consumer lending, or expected softening in demand in consumer lending because of rates rising? And are they expecting that people will default, or are they saying it because they're just going to become tighter about their own credit standards? Because there's a very big difference in those two things. So we have to listen very closely to what bank CEOs say. I think that they'll probably be positive on what happened in the quarter, but perhaps not so positive on what might occur for the rest of the year.
We spent a lot of time talking about JP Morgan, for example, and this is anecdotal, but Bank of America today down 3%, JP Morgan's down half of that, 1.5%. That makes sense. Elizabeth said, you know, these hold to maturity losses on these balance sheets, when 10-year yields were 5% in the fall, I've said this before, I think the number for Bank of America was somewhere between $114 and $117 billion of unrealized hold to maturity losses. Obviously, that got mitigated when yields went to 3.8%. Mm-hmm. But on the way back up, that's going to be a story again. I'm just pointing it out just to point it out. Liz does an amazing job on the Twitter, and she puts graphs. And who's that cat? Mario. Yeah. Well, let's go to her tweet, because, you know, again, when you see it, visually see things, and when you see these graphs, things start to make a lot of sense. And this has everything to do with CPI year over year.
Yeah. So, and this was just basically a regurgitation of what was going on this morning. So CPI comes out. The thing that's interesting about this chart is that if you look at the latest bar, you've got the argument, all of the arguments that people have made up until this point about why inflation is still not a problem or why it's still coming down are getting less and less persuasive, because all of these bars over here are above the line and expanding, which is a problem, right? This is a thing where we've had people say, well, services are still high, but goods have all come down. Now look at that little, I know it's a tiny part, but that little salmon colored piece on the top, still rising. That's goods, energy, and food. And I heard somebody today, or I read it on Twitter, arguing that, well, food prices are still coming down. Unless your diet consists entirely of cereal, milk products, and sugar, food prices are still rising.
Yes.
And if your diet does consist of cereal, milk products, and sugar, your healthcare costs are about to rise. So you're still losing.
Lose. No, that's, thank you for that, because it's effing insulting to people that are trying to make ends meet when they hear, you know, again, I didn't see any of the administration people, the lackeys they put out there. And that's both sides, by the way, saying how we're winning the war. People see what's going on. I mean, again, just to emphasize, when you hear inflation is coming down, that's not what's happening. It's just going up less fast. Anyway, please continue, because that's exactly what's happening.
So that's problem number one. Problem number two in this chart is what we're calling the supercore. I've talked about this ad nauseum, but that supercore metric is what the Fed had started to talk about, saying this is the true measure of underlying inflation. It's core services, ex shelter. Basically, let's take out everything that is a problem, and this will show us that everything is okay. You'll notice that the blue bar is expanding as well. So now core services are expanding. Then you'll have people say, well, shelter is the only thing that's really not going down yet, but it will go down because of rates and yada, yada, yada. That dark bar in the middle is shelter also expanding. So there isn't much in this report that I can even try to dig to say everything is getting better or even something is getting better. At the very best, we are sort of holding steady, but even that argument doesn't hold water anymore.
Well, it's interesting. What else is about to be at the hold steady mark is Fed speak. And there's a Fed speak sentiment index.
There is.
And you have this. This is, again, tightening bias, loosening bias. We're almost smack in the middle here.
So, right. And so this, and that's exactly what I said in the note. This index, and looking at it this way, can be misleading because it looks like they're edging toward a loosening bias, right? Look like they're edging toward a cutting bias. All it's really shown us is that the tightening bias has become lesser. We're inching toward the line where we're 50-50 between hikes and cuts, honestly. And I don't think that that's a very safe place to be. We're going to sort of chug around in this zone while the market tries to figure out what's next. I think what's next is that if we get a hot PPI print tomorrow, we get cuts pushed out to the end of the year, and then you start hearing a lot more chatter about the possibility of another hike.
Yeah. Well, that's maybe the thing. If we go from, you know, being priced six cuts to the potential for no cuts and then possibly a hike, you know, that's the thing that the S&P 500, I guess, would probably have to take at least you know, a pause on here and possibly a correction. I want to go to the Russell 2000 for a second here, because, again, you know, this is a sector, small caps. We know that, you know, access to credit. And again, you know, this is, you know, important part of that story there. I mean, that would probably be the hardest hit group, I would expect, if you were to see, you know, rate cuts priced out and then possibly hikes coming here. You know, you can draw a line from those October lows. You see that it's broken that uptrend. We've done that also in the S&P 500. The technicals, Liz, are starting to deteriorate, at least for the indices, because they've lost some momentum to the upside a little bit. And, you know, there's a lot of folks who've been talking about, you know, the market broadening out and the like here. But, you know, a guy just mentioned NVIDIA, which quickly became the third largest stock in the S&P 500. You know, that thing is down more than, you know, 12 or so percent from its recent highs. If you just start to lose the leadership, then what does the new leadership come from? I don't think it can exist in the financials, you know, space. I don't think, you know, banks or, you know, any other sorts of lenders or whatever, especially in this rate environment. So all of a sudden you start saying to yourself, industrials, well, a lot of them are multinationals, you know, the dollar, let's throw the Dixie up there. Guy, this is one of the biggest one day moves that I can remember in the Dixie in a very long time. So that's a US dollar index. So when you think about higher rates, higher dollar, higher gasoline, higher, you know, other commodities and like, these are all things that will be headwinds to, you know, earnings. I mean, margins, you know what I mean? So I don't know. I think there's a lot of things that are kind of screaming in silence right now. But like, again, I go back to what we talked about maybe 15 minutes ago. Why is the S&P only down 1%?
Well, here's what I think will happen first. If we end up in a more concentrated drawdown, first of all, you give up the broadening out trade.
Yep.
All of the broadening that's happened since the beginning of the year, predicated on the economy strengthening, cyclicals rallying, small caps rallying, all of that, I think you give up the broadening. So some of the stuff that has gone up the most in that period will give the most of it back, maybe with the exception of energy. then I think investors take that money and go to the stuff that has served them well up until this point, which has been big tech. It's been those big names. That little period, though, depending on how everything goes, that little period may be short-lived if it's on the back of the economy starting to weaken, because those big tech names, and to your conversation before, discretionary spending turning into, or saying that discretionary spending is actually necessary spending, it will start to turn into, where do we cut now because there isn't enough money left?
There's something in your world, now I'm segueing a bit here, called bad Greek, negative gamma. You familiar with this term?
A little bit.
So I'm just sitting paying attention because, as you know, Dan,
that's the cheapest thing you can do.
So the S&P's, since we've been sitting here, rallied about 23 handles off the low. Of course it did.
In our face.
You know what else just rallied pretty significantly? The volatility index. So the VIX just went from sort of 15 and a half or so. Now it's 16.10. You'd be like, okay, you're making a big... What you're about to see now, in my opinion, is the impact of negative gamma, people chasing. So the moves higher are going to be exaggerated as more and more people that are short volatility have to buy things, and the moves lower are going to be equally exaggerated. Lower things go, the more people have to sell when they are short volatility. So when you see the VIX spike like it has over the last 15 minutes and the market move like it has, I'm telling you, that's something you have to watch very closely.
It's funny, you know, we think about this and you know, okay, you could have bought retailers, you could have bought industrials, you could have bought energy, you could have bought this, you know, even utilities have been working of late. I mean, there's like everything was working in the stock market, right? And then when you were getting the massive outperformance, it was getting narrower and narrower. It was in some of these names that were really clearly, you know, like tied to the generative AI trade. You know, you had NVIDIA at one point that was up 90% on the year. You had Meta that was up 45% on the year. You know, there's a handful of names, big names, that were driving a lot of this performance. I look at the major indices. I see the S&P 500 up a little more than 8% on the year. I see the NASDAQ up a little more than 7% on the year. The Russell is flat on the year. And I say to myself, okay, we already went over the Russell. If you bought the stock market, the major indices at any point over the last, you know, 3 to 4 months, you've done just fine. You know what I mean? Or whatever. So I guess the point is, what is the thing that causes people to panic a little bit? You know what I mean? To basically, and it's not panicking up 8% on the year. It's just when everybody heads for the door at the same time, that's when you get a down 3% day of the NASDAQ, a down 2% day in the S&P. Hopefully you'll get a little bit of follow through. You'll get a VIX above 20 guy. You know what I mean? Like, you know, you get some of those things where people say, okay, well, that really happened kind of quickly.
It's going to be non-market related.
You think
it's
so?
Well, I agree. It's going to be some escalation in the Middle East. And, you know, if you watch these shows, they're seemingly on the clock in terms of what happens, you know, with Iran. Yeah. I mean, we'll see. I want to be crystal effing clear. We're not wishing for that. I'm just trying to answer your question. So it's going to be some sort of non-market exogenous event that people might see out there, but have clearly not priced in. That's what will start to make things move. That's when people will take notice of what's going on in the market, I think.
But, you know, Liz, last week there was a day, and I can't remember which day it was, there was a leg lower in the S&P 500. Was it last Thursday, maybe? And a lot of folks were saying, well, it was like Fed Chair Bostic said there's only going to be one cut this year or something like that. And they thought that was it. Other folks were saying there was something. Was it the, I guess it was the warning about Iran
April 4th, I think
it was. Like that.
I think.
And so that's interesting to me, that guy's answer of that. And listen, it could be a combination of both. It could be that the higher rate environment, the higher dollar, you know, the valuations in the S&P 500, earnings season, and then you get just the spark that kind of lights the flame a little bit.
Yeah, I have. I'm looking for it. I tweeted that day because it was a big reversal day.
Yeah.
And if you looked at the timing of when the reversal happened, it didn't line up with the Fed speak. It didn't line up with some of the obvious issues. It did line up more with the news out of the Middle East.
Yeah. All right, let's do this here, because usually we do this on Thursdays, guy, but we're going to do it on Wednesday here because this is a great topic for Liz. And, you know, we get a preview of our main man, John Butters. He's the senior earnings insight analyst over there at FactSet. He writes every week the earnings insight blog. You can have it delivered to your email or your email box.
You have it in your inbox of your email.
You can have that too. Yeah, there you go. insight.factset.com/subscribe there, people. But what John's talking about this week, and I think this is really important, obviously, because here we are, we're heading into Q1 earnings season. And let's be clear, you know, Q1 it's kind of baked in the cake, at least as far as the markets are concerned. What we're going to move on is forward guidance, right? Q2 and the balance of the year, Liz. So let's look at what Butters is looking at here. The S&P 500 is currently expected to report earnings growth of 3.1% for Q1. However, the index will likely report actual earnings growth of at least 7% for Q1 due to companies reporting positive EPS surprises. Mm-hmm. Over the past 5 years, 77% of S&P 500 companies have beaten EPS estimates on average. Over the last 10 years, 74%. Overall, the actual earnings growth rate has finished higher than the estimated earnings growth rate in 37 of the past 40 quarters. All right, talk to me, Guy Adami. When you look at that data here, it looks like 3.1%, but we're going to get a beat here, people. Is that baked in the cake?
So I'm going to try to figure out why this may be. Yeah. Again, not suggesting I'm right. I think, remember, so 40 quarters is 10 years. Think about, right? Is that correct?
Correct.
Think about what we've enjoyed for the last 10 years or so. Interest, basically a zero interest rate environment. That has been a tremendous tailwind that I think most people, including myself, have underappreciated, which is one of the reasons I think these numbers speak to exactly that. 37 out of 40 quarters over the last 10 years, basically three quarters of the S&P 500 companies have beaten EPS estimates. That's what I think is going on. Let's see what happens in an interest rate environment that's not been typical over the last 10 or so years. I think, just my opinion, I think as we start to see a headwind to margins and stuff, these numbers are going to dramatically decrease. Just my thoughts.
I think there's going to be something else that happens, not this quarter, maybe not even next quarter, but later in the year. If this is a reignition in inflation due to commodity prices, companies can no longer justify passing through increased costs because of oil or because of copper or because of gold. It doesn't even make sense in a lot of industries. So no longer can they raise the revenue line by justifying price increases, yet the costs will go up nevertheless. Mm-hmm. And wage costs continue to stay high. So I think that's where you start to see the compression. I don't necessarily expect that we're going to see a huge disappointment in earnings over certain quarters. But you got to think, what do companies have to do when they report their earnings? They have to give guidance. They have to take guesses too. They have to guess as to what demand is going to be. They have to guess as to what costs are going to look like. They can only control so much.
Yeah, but they should and have some good that. Visibility for, the,
they
for
should.
The 3 months. By the time
unless
they are
unless they're driven
their...
by consumers.
But think
and
about
consumers
this.
Switch it, and that's where you see those inventory problems.
Yeah, right. But I mean, those usually build up over quarters. I mean, when you think about, let's just say all the major tech companies are reporting in the last week of April, they are literally a third through the quarter in which they are guiding for, right? So like again, you know, they have really good visibility. They should have really good visibility on the quarter. The one last thing I want to say about John's work on that, as far as like that beat rate, okay, mm-hmm. over the last 10 years. And Guy, I think you nailed it, okay? It's like, where were interest rates on average over the last 10 years? They were literally, like in and around 1% or so on average. You know what companies were also doing? They were buying back their stock and they were massaging those earnings, right? Like mm-hmm. the whole time. And that also is, I think, what starts to change. So hopefully Butters will take a look at stock buybacks. You know what I mean? In interest rates environments, because I think it's less interesting for these companies to take out debt, right, at these levels and buy back their stock. That's just my two cents.
It's the Q&A portion of our show. Unless I miss something. No, Elizabeth, did I miss anything?
I don't think
Dan?
So.
Nope, we're good.
Scott A. asks, watch this. Watch it pop up on the screen. Would like Guy's thoughts on the U.S. dollar against the Japanese yen move? Hmm. Thank you for that, Scott. Now, if you're an on-the-tape listener, viewer, I guess listener,
yeah.
Danny Moses, we started to talk about dollar-yen and the ramifications a long time ago. As we're sitting here today, dollar-yen is now basically 150, slightly below 153. Apparently, the line in the sand for the Bank of Japan was 152, so that line has obviously been somewhat altered. This is my thoughts. Japan has a problem. And I'm not trying to get all melancholy here or hyperbolic. What I'll say is, right before our eyes, you're going to start hearing more and more people talk about the potential for a currency crisis there. Now, in terms of their exports, this is huge for them, which is why the Nikkei has been doing as well as it's been doing. For their citizenry, this is a effing disaster. And the Bank of Japan is going to have to do something. They can intervene in their currency, which will do absolutely nothing. It might sort of assuage some of the concerns for a few hours, or they can start to ratchet up rates in a meaningful way, which is probably what they're going to have to do. There is no magic bullet here. So I think the yen weakness it just, again, my opinion, is something that the broader market is going to start to take into consideration.
All right, so Liz, let me ask you this. So the Bank of Japan was at the first rate increase, and it was slight, right?
10
that
basis
they've had
points.
In a very, very long time.
17 years.
So if we went from one of the narratives, and I know you talked about it a bit, is like these competing forces between these different central banks, right? Mm-hmm. As we had gone on this rate hiking cycle over the mm-hmm. last, call it, year and a half or so, and then we're moving to the pause and then the cut, and then other banks were going to have to get tighter in their policy. And so here we are now. Are we going to find ourselves actually once again competing with other central banks to get more restrictive? And what are the knock-on effects of that, if that is the case, right, over the next, call it, few months into year end?
Well, I think it's moving in a lot of different directions. So versus Japan competing to get more restrictive, sure. Versus Europe might cut sooner rather than later. And then you've got a euro dollar parity mm-hmm. issue going on. So it's currency volatility, period. And I think that that's what's driving a lot of this gold trade. And it's not getting enough airtime, honestly, about people buying, central banks buying gold because of currency volatility, because of some of these risks. And all central banks are starting to move at different times in different directions because they're dealing with different problems. The dollar continues to strengthen, which I think people have decided is a good thing for us. And in a lot of ways it is, but it's not a good thing for some of the earnings. It's not a good thing for inflationary reasons. So you've got issues that I think are going to continue to heat up as the year goes on and as different regions try to fight whatever the inflation problem is that they're having. Mm-hmm.
Back to that bad Greek. So I think I pointed that out at about 118. So the S&P went up 20 handles and it's retraced that entire move. So this is, again, negative gamma right before our very eyes. This is for you, Elizabeth, because I think you're very qualified. From Michael Westrick. Views on the TMF TLT trade. I think that TMF is some sort of levered 20-year ETF, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if you have thoughts on this or not.
20-year plus treasury yield three times. Yeah.
Well, look at me. So I actually did know what it was.
She's not going to opine on that. Why don't you just talk about the TLT?
But you've talked about maybe something else you talked about. But talk about, again, the TLT and obviously this bond auction that you highlighted right after the top of the hour.
Well, the bond auction was a 10-year auction. And it didn't draw as much demand. So it went for a higher yield than what was expected, which obviously shot yields up. That can have a snowball effect if we start to see that happen. We had some jitters about that late last year where there were some auctions that didn't go well. The problem with it being, if there's no buyers out there, yields just continue to rise. It's like this silent push on yields upward. Mm-hmm. And if there's less demand, not only from China and other big institutional buyers, then there's going to be less auction success. So not only are we looking at inflation as an issue, we are looking at Fed not cutting as an issue. Now we might be looking at less demand for treasuries across the curve as an issue that push yields up. And the higher for longer narrative continues to be one that proves correct. And it proves correct out across the curve, particularly the longer portion of the curve. So I would be careful here, but I do think that if the 10-year starts to get closer to 5% again, that's a buy signal.
Wavy McFly, who's with us all the time. I don't think he was born Wavy or McFly.
Would be pretty cool if he was.
Well, would be cool. Maybe his parents had a sense of humor. Yeah. Who knows? We have higher inflation than 1970s. It's not entirely true, but okay. And then he says, why wouldn't it seem logical to have rates go back to where we were in the times of Paul Volcker? Well, I think, and again, what do I say all the time? I'm not smart enough nor humorless enough to be an economist, but I was been around for a while. I mean, the economy is completely different. There were a lot of factors, different factors at work in the 1970s. With that said, I think your point is, I'm trying to make a bit of a leap here, rates can go higher. I think people underestimate how high rates can go. I agree. Jamie Dimon, in that 61-page missive the other day, said pretty much exactly that he thinks rates can go to 8% or so. So again, I don't think we're going to the 1970s levels of interest rates, which I think we're at 17% or so-ish. I think the economy's different. I think a lot of things are different. However, I still think people are underestimating how high yields can go.
Yeah, here's a good one here. Let's go to Jack Nargundakar. So thanks, Jack, for the question here. He says, at Risk Reversal Media, if earnings season gets off to a good start next week, today's downturn will be seen as a blip.
Yeah.
Please comment. Well, I mean, Jack, my crystal ball is a little fuzzy at the moment here. I'm not so sure. What does that mean? Like a good earnings season? I mean, like we just told you that expectations from FactSet are expected 3.1%, you know, EPS growth. You know, so that's baked in the cake. That's what the expectations are. If they come in slightly better to John's work that we were just talking about, that's fine. It really comes down to guidance, the visibility, and Liz's pushback to me about the guidance is really important. When you have the dollar moving around this way, when you have yields moving around this way, that decreases your visibility if you are in the C-level suite. So you are 100% correct on that. All I'm saying is, at least for Q2 guidance, companies should be able to guide within a fairly tight range as they are a third of the way through that quarter. Now, how they think about, Liz, the balance of the year, that's kind of different here. And so the other point I'll make is the S&P is already up 8% on the year. You want to annualize that quarterly return? The S&P expectations for earnings don't justify it. So there's something has to give at some point.
Yeah, I think the other thing, Jack, is that maybe what you're referring to is investors will have short memories of what happened today. And if we have a hot PPI tomorrow and it drives things down further, we'll forget all about it if we get some good news on the other side. And that may be true, but they'll have just as short of a memory as we go further into it and if we get worse news. So I think we have to be careful to think about it. There's short-term moves, and then there's the longer-term issue that a lot of this is driving. And the longer-term issue is usually what I'm focused on. The longer-term issue is that inflation is not solved. The longer-term issue is that capital is constricted, and that if we start cutting too soon, we reignite and overheat again, in which case nobody wins.
Chris E., thoughts on the Dow 30 laggards like UNH, which is stock-specific, industry-specific in terms of what's going on with UNH, Humana, and some of the other names. McDonald's, which is another name somewhat specific to McDonald's, although I think speaks to a broader economy thing. Apple, we've talked about. These are the names that he brought. Johnson & Johnson and Nike. Each one of those, as I was trying to say, is probably their own idiosyncratic story. But then in a collective, you could say, you know what, there are a lot of similarities here too. I'll say this, in terms of Nike, we've talked about it before. I think the China situation is one thing. The fact that competition has come seemingly out of nowhere in the form of, what are those things, Hokas and those types of things. Yeah. I think it caught Nike
a
bit off guard.
You have a pair of Hokas.
I
do. You
do? Absolutely. Yeah. Why do you laugh at that? But I'll also say this, you know, we outlined yesterday the potential for Nike specifically to sort of hold this level. You see that prior low. So this is actually becoming pretty interesting pretty quickly. I'll say this about Apple. I'm not a hater. I don't give a shit, but I'm not one of these people that wait online. I didn't read Steve Jobs' book, and this guy I'm sure is lovely, and people that wait, like that one cat who everything they put out, he seems like with the glasses and all that shit. If you're doing it, you're living life the wrong way. I'll say this, though. I mean, Apple's got a – they have a valuation problem. They have a cost problem. They have a margin problem. They have a China – I can go on and on here. You can say their balance sheet is great. Yeah, that's been true for a while. You know what? The stock has been telling you something since July of last year, Dan Nathan.
Yeah. Liz, what do you make of, you know, and it's interesting because UNH, obviously a big stock, Apple, a big stock. These stocks are really underperforming. Even like, you know, Guy mentioned McDonald's. You know, McDonald's is down on the year. McDonald's is down 12% from its 52-week highs. A lot of really important names, if you just think about them as, you know, market leaders in their respective spaces, have really not been acting particularly well. This is not too different than what we saw in late 2021 when the Fed basically said, we are going to battle inflation by rising interest rates. I think, guys, and we've been talking about this on the tape, and we've been talking about it on Market Call for months and months. We've been saying that it feels a lot like late 2021. A lot of the activity that we've seen this reemergence in crypto. We've seen a whole host of things, you know, like going on that, you know, we don't have the SPACs. We've seen some IPOs that don't make sense and valuations. And again, so like, Liz, this reminds me a lot of 2021. And under the hood, if you were looking at the way some major prior market leaders were acting, it was giving you a good heads up in 2021 of what was to come in 2022. So my question is, if the broadening out theme is the thing that is keeping bulls in the game right now, I'm not sure that holds.
Well, I don't think it does hold. And I think what's happening, it happened yesterday and it's happening again today. Everything that had been at the top of every quintile quickly moved to the bottom of the quintile performance-wise. So it was as if everything that had worked just got sent out to pasture. And I'll read you something from my note tomorrow.
Oh, please.
If the broadening out story, the bull case for markets, and the mid-cycle argument have all been at least somewhat predicated on the idea that inflation is moving closer to target and the Fed is sharpening its knives, investors are coming to grips with the possibility that those theses are busted. And I think that's what's happening here. Every time you make a purchase, you have to have a thesis about it. Maybe your thesis is simply momentum. Maybe it's simply price appreciation and multiple expansion. If rates are going to stay higher, that thesis is busted. Momentum has completely conked out, maybe not entirely reversed to the downside, but conked out. If your thesis was that demand was going to stay strong, the consumer was going to keep spending, higher rates also put a pinch on that. Higher inflation definitely puts a pinch on that. That thesis is busted. So all of the reasons that we bought a lot of these stocks up until now are falling away. And it doesn't mean that they're bad stocks at all. It doesn't mean that they're bad companies and that they don't deserve to be bought. I think that a lot of the buying has been happening because of macro and because of sentiment and because of the belief of what the Fed was going to do. And now we have to go back and decide, do these stocks deserve to be bought just based on their own merits and fundamentals? And maybe that's what will happen.
AMAT reports on the 16th of May, Dan Nathan. Mm-hmm. This is a company that trades probably 20 and a half times next year's numbers. You probably have 14% EPS growth ish, less than that revenue growth. Great company. Pull up the stock. It's been on a tear. On April 8th, Cantor Fitzgerald upgraded the stock to overweight from neutral, $260 price target. The question is from Wallace Vincent, or Vincent Wallace. Hard to tell. Thoughts on AMAT and the Cantor Fitz upgrade to begin the week. That 50-day is begging to hang out. I don't know where the 50-day moving average is. I'm sorry. Amanda can pull up a chart. We can find it. Here's what I'll say. This is just my opinion. Great company. Lower left, upper right. Valuation, you can make a compelling case. I see what Cantor did. Actually, Cantor's been right on this name, by the way, and they just upgraded. So that neutral rating with the 220 price target was actually the right thing to do. The 50-day moving average, I guess, is right there. I'm looking, Dan, that's 197. So maybe that's where you enter it if they miss or ahead of earnings. But this is actually a name I actually sort of like in this environment because you can rationalize it on valuation.
Yeah. So, again, I think it's pretty interesting that you're getting upgrades here. You know, this is a stock that, again, does trade cheap to many of its peers. But this is a huge beneficiary of all the reshoring of these chip plants. So we've seen the IRA, you know, doling out, you know, what was it, $20 billion between grants and low interest loans to Intel. Taiwan Semi just got about $11 billion combined. That was announced in the last week or two. When you look at AMAT's huge customers, so they make the equipment that makes, you know, semiconductors here, they should be a huge beneficiary, okay, of these new fabs being built here in the US. So when you tell me that this stock trades at about 21 times next year's, you know, maybe it's going to, you know, high single digits, low double digits earnings growth, I say, you know, you want to buy this on a pullback. And I'm pretty sure this is the A in my zebra guy. This is the
I didn't know that.
Yeah, how about
that?
Apologize. So yeah, well, that's fine.
I should know these
and,
things.
And so, you know, but like to me, I just think that that's not a bad
well, that's been working for you, well, your zebra.
Yeah, well, there you go, guy.
Elizabeth, did you have a dog growing up?
No.
How is that possible?
I had a cat.
Okay. Well, that's for another show. Much different
she
conversation.
Lived for 21 years.
Of course she did.
Got her when I was five.
That's what cats
she
do.
Lived until I was done with college.
You know what her cat's name now is? Biddy.
Biddy.
Itty bitty kitty.
Itty bitty kitty.
Okay, I probably Itty, should end the show right
bitty,
now.
Kitty. That
you see.
She is
you,
quite small.
So and ironically, you know, I have a 22-pound cat. Uh-huh. Which is not a small cat.
Your cat okay. found the
I'm so sorry I went down this route. But I mentioned it because some of the dumber breeds of dog, they'll be sitting
like
there.
Flip?
No, Flip is very smart.
Oh.
They'll be sitting there and seemingly out of nowhere, they'll start chasing their tail. Uh-huh. They'll go clockwise, like a million miles. And then all of a sudden they'll stop and go the other way.
Yeah.
And you say, what the F is that dog doing? Chasing your tail. And you say, okay, guy, please, I'm begging you. This is a question from JM460, okay?
Yeah.
Maybe JM was born in April of 1960. That's how I read this. I don't know. Can you explain what it means when the market goes into negative gamma? See, now I'm setting this up. People have been rewarded for selling volatility. So they've been able to sit on their lawn chairs, sell vol, they earn that because nothing bad ever happens, right? So they're hanging out. Then all of a sudden something happens. And in the same way, the dog who seemingly out of nowhere starts chasing his tail to the right and then to the left, That's the same way these Johnsons are going to have to start. The lower things go, the more they have to sell vis-a-vis being short volatility. And then conversely, as things start to go the other way and the higher things go, the more they have to buy. That's why you're seeing intraday moves like we're seeing on a day like today with the VIX now at 16, 15 or so.
What do you mean by sell volatility?
No.
When people sell options and earn that premium and then sit back and like, this is an easy game. That's great. When the vol starts working against you, it's not so great. We call that negative whip. We call that bad Greek. You call it whatever you want, but you're seeing it in spades today, Dan.
Yeah, and there's some good explainers online. I mean, if you think about like the
No. That was a great explainer.
I didn't mean it. I didn't mean it like that. But my point is that if gamma measures the rate of change of the delta of an option, you know, if you are an options dealer and someone comes in and they want to buy an option from you and you're going to sell it, you're going to hedge that out to a delta. You're going to like delta hedge that. And so the gamma measures how much expectation of the movement of that delta. And then if everything starts moving, like you start chasing, this is where you get to the, that was a good explanation here. So again, there's probably some more detailed explanation.
Yeah, but I explained it in a way that people understand.
If you're a visual learner instead of an audio.
That's all I meant, guy. Jeez.
Can we pull up Dan's?
He's the most insensitive. Like you are not sensitive.
Not at all.
You have very thick skin. Maybe I'm just getting, after 15 years, I'm getting under your skin.
No, not at all. But
negative whip.
It's a bad Greek. Okay. Throw that one out there.
Whip is also a baseball stat.
Yes, it is.
Walks and hits per innings
pitch. Yes, it is. And one of the leading teams now in the whip early this season are New York Yankees by virtue of the fact that they're not giving up a lot of hits and they're not giving up a lot of walks. Boston Red Sox, oddly enough, Dan, as you know, right now statistically have the best pitching staff in baseball.
Yes.
You don't care.
Surgeons
can we pull up Dan Zieber?
Look at that. So here's what I do. We come up with these acronyms in the beginning of the year. And the whole idea is to get outperformance, right? So when I was in 12th grade, I was in an economics class.
Sure, okay. You were high school.
And we had to like play some game by picking like securities, stocks and this and whatever. And I didn't know much about the stock market, but I remember thinking about it. So this was probably 1990 or 1991 or so. And I picked a couple stocks that had crazy yields. So they would annualize over a short period of time. And then I picked some stocks that I just like knew the name of. And I looked at you had to look in the newspaper. You know what I mean? And you had to look at 52-week highs, 52-week lows where I was trading that were down a lot. I can't remember like where I got that idea because I didn't know jack about the stock market and I won that competition.
Sure you did.
So now this competition
is
too different in a way. So a company like Zoom that has a lot of cash, I think it's an acquisition target. A company like Rivian, which was trading at all-time lows down 90%, which will have a lot of leverage if they ever start doing things correctly. That could be a double. You know what I mean? Like that sort of AMAT was purely valuation. And I think just really solid fundamentals and like a theme. So Bobby was washed out, right? Like, you know what I mean? Like that to me. So that's how I picked some of these things. EA was also a more of an acquisition.
You could have now watch the way my mind works.
Yeah, I want to see this.
You could have added another stock. You could have added Netflix.
Yeah.
And then you could have changed your Zebra into Brazen. See what I did there? That's a Brazen acronym. So it works not
that
only on the acronym.
So much better.
Brazen.
Yeah, but I wouldn't have been buying. So Netflix would not
I threw an N out there. Okay, that was that I threw out there.
Did you have to do an acronym?
I did.
Annoying.
So I started with COM, C-A-L-M.
It turned into?
Oh, COM.
But apparently, Bonawin used COM.
But we changed it on Guy because we have more.
So I said, you know what? Why don't we change it to CLAM? You're smiling. Okay. Uh-huh. So now I have my clam that we're talking about.
We talk about Guy's clam a lot. So we're like, so we'll be like the M in Guy's clam.
It's Martin Marietta, which pull that.
And
bitch
interestingly,
up.
The L in your
Lockheed
clam
Martin.
So you went with a heavy defense theme in your clam.
And the A is Agnico Eagle Mines. That's a miner. Elizabeth's final trade last Thursday, I believe, on the HTR was GDX. Am I correct?
That's correct.
And was my math right?
Yep.
Yeah.
And then the C is either Chevron or ConocoPhillips. I've forgotten. But they're, you get my drift.
Yeah, we do.
All right. Well, look, we've taken up enough of Elizabeth's time and the audience's time. We addressed a lot of questions. We explained a lot of things. Today, the rest of the day is going to be, I think, fascinating. Tomorrow, we have PPI, Producer Price Index. Yeah. Today is a consumer. Tomorrow is a producer. I think one speaks to inflation. I think the other one speaks maybe more to the economy. I don't know. That's how I look at it. But we're going to learn a lot. And that Johnson Austin Goolsbee, and Elizabeth and I talked about this on Monday.
She didn't call me Johnson.
No, she did not.
By the way,
I did.
Your podcast, the two of you on Monday that came out on the tape, was excellent.
Well, people liked it. I heard about that.
Is that right?
I really enjoyed it.
What do they call it when you vibe?
You got your vibe. It's called you.
Oh, they say that?
We were vibing.
It's kind of like Brunson.
Huh?
I am a vibe. You know that AT&T commercial?
Let me tell you
that's
something.
That's a great commercial.
And in the history of player. In the history of New York free agent signings, mm-hmm. and it's a long history, he is the best free agent signing in the history, not of New York Nick, of New York sports, period. Mm-hmm. That includes Catfish Hunter, that you remember. Reginald Martinez Jackson, who you remember. And other people like that. Mm. All right, nobody cares.
Liz, do you?
I would mention the Mets, but they suck at everything.
How come you don't hate the Islanders as much as you hate the Mets?
I do now.
Oh, I see.
Because last night's, historically, I hate the Islanders. They've been an afterthought. But last night, they basically put themselves back in the conversation. Because now all the Islander fans are chirping. And you know a few of them.
I do.
And John Ledecky, I'm not throwing around him. Names. I know, we know John. He's a fan of Fast Money. We see him all the time.
He's a great
I team. Love the guy.
Yeah.
I hate his effing team. He knows this. He respects me for that. Doug Cifu. You know Doug, right? He owns the Florida Panthers. I'm not a Panther fan. I like Doug. They're not mutually exclusive. Hmm. Okay, Dan's done with me.
No, I'm with you.
Amanda's saying, let's roll. JM said he's born in April 1960, so guy is spot on. I mean, holy shit.
It's probably his PIN number for his ATM card.
I hacked your ass, baby. You better change it now. No. That's it. We'll see you tomorrow. Oh, it's just tomorrow. It's going to be me and Carter Braxton. By the way, special time tomorrow, 2 o'clock.
Yes.
Because I have to do something. So 2 p.m. So if you turn on the YouTube at 1, you don't see me. It didn't break. Tomorrow we're doing it at 2 because I got to be in Jersey City for something. Ooh. And then I'm jackassing it through the river, under the river, and over the bridge. The grandmother's house we go. But 2 o'clock tomorrow, Carter Worth, G Swizzle, tune in. See you later.
See you, everyone.